Good morning. I'd like to welcome everybody to the Mesa City Council Study Session for Thursday, February 19th, 2009. I'd like to excuse Vice Mayor Jones, who's out of town, and Councilmember Summers, who has work-related conflicts this morning. So we'll move ahead with agenda item number one, hear a presentation, discuss and provide direction on the Mesa Gateway Strategic Development Plan. Mr. Wesley?
Morning, Mayor and Council. Get this ready to go. Here this morning to talk to you a little bit about some of the implementation items from the Mesa Gateway Strategic Development Plan and get some direction from this body as we move forward with implementing those particular items. Any of these things that we choose to do would need to go back through a public review process and through the Planning and Zoning Board and then back to this group for final action. The Mesa Gateway Strategic Development Plan had three recommendations that we're looking at this time for how we might move forward with. The first was to look at the existing land use designations in the area and the recommendations from the Mesa Gateway Strategic Development Plan and see if there's a need for any plan amendments, land use amendments to the general plan to make the two plans more consistent. Second was to look at the definition of what constitutes a major plan amendment in this area to see if we should make a change to make it easier to modify the general plan designations to be consistent, to bring the two plans together. And the third would be to potentially process a major plan amendment to get consistency in those land use designations. So I'm going to review each of these three items. First, in looking at the area with the existing general plan designations and the different districts that were created in the area for any discrepancies or differences, really only found one major area where we think there's a need to look at changes in land use designation, and that's in the inner loop area. As we look at the others, the mixed-use community, the logistics and commerce, and airport campus districts, those land use designations that are currently in place pretty well cover the types of uses expected there, and any adjustments would be fairly minor. But in the inner loop, we see that big area of light industrial. The inner loop area calls for a mix of office, industrial, retail uses with some possibility of residential happening at high density in the future. And that much light industrial doesn't really lead us to that mix of uses. So that's the area we want to concentrate on to see if there might be some better ways to approach the land use designations in that location. So in that inner loop area, we have a couple of options we could consider. One would be to try to determine what we think an appropriate mix of uses would be in that area and work with property owners to come in and designate areas for commercial or office or industrial type uses. The second would be to utilize one of our existing mixed-use designations that we have. We have the mixed-use community, the mixed-use employment, and the mixed-use residential districts or land use designations that could be applied to the area, and that gives individual property owners more flexibility by using the mixed-use designation. We may need to modify one or more of the existing mixed-use designations if they don't fit exactly, or we could create some new mixed-use district if we thought that would be more appropriate for the area, mixed-use airport, for lack of a better term, maybe we could come up with to apply to the area. But as we've looked at our existing definitions, the mixed-use employment definition that we currently have, that current designation, is pretty close to what we think we need. It allows a pretty good variety of employment uses. And so it's our recommendation, as I'll go through here in just a moment, that we look at modifying that specific land use designation for better use in this area. Before we do that, though, I want to just quickly highlight where we currently have mixed-use employment designations in the community. If we change the definition, that new definition would apply to any of these locations where we have this designation. And as we look at those, we don't really see that there would be any significant difficulty, negative impacts of the changes on any of those areas. So the current definition for mixed-use employment describes that it's a place for a mix of employment uses, including office, retail, commercial, and business park, effectively combined in a coordinated campus environment. Again, that's a pretty good definition for what we're looking for in this area with just a couple of minor adjustments that we're proposing. One is we add industrial in there. Currently, this doesn't allow for the industrial. The area is currently allowing industrial. We think that's a good use in this area. The Mesa Gateway Plan talks about industrial uses in the inner loop area. And so I think it would be helpful to add that in to this mixed-use employment area. Then also, currently it has that term coordinated campus environment. nobody really knows exactly what campus environment is supposed to mean, and it caused some people some concern about what that means and how we might employ that. And the Mesa Gateway Plan, in particular for that area, has some definitions about form and what we're looking for in terms of that development appearance. So we think it could be helpful to take out that word campus. The next part of the definition says that hotels may be allowed and residential is not permitted in this category. In the Interloop area, we've talked about residential maybe at some point being appropriate on a case-by-case basis. So to allow for that possibility, we're also considering the idea that we could add this phrase after that, at the end of that sentence, provided, however, that council may approve high-density residential development as part of an integrated mixed-use project through a use permit process. So it wouldn't be something that could just happen by right. The current example that we have is in the C2 district, you can get residential through a council use permit. And so that type of approach, whatever it might be in this area, is what we're thinking we could then do through the zoning ordinance, so that if anybody does want to do residential, it has to meet these criteria and be specifically approved by council. So those are our recommended modifications to the mixed-use employment designation. We think if we do that, it would be pretty appropriate then to be applied in that Interloop area and achieve the direction proposed by the Mesa Gateway Strategic Plan. Maybe before I go on to the other items, see if there's any comment or discussion about those, about this part of it.
I have a question, Mr. Wesley. If we change this definition on mixed-use employment, does that apply to those that are already designated, or does that apply, would apply just to this in the gateway?
That would be a
general definition.
That's
then.
Right. That becomes the definition. It would apply any place we have the mixed-use
employment. So all those areas that were marked in blue then?
On this map.
On that one map.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Councilmember Higgins?
John, I kind of, the word campus I thought was put in there to develop more integrated projects along the lines of the ASU Research Park, where we had walkable areas between big industries. So I thought that was still the kind of look you were going for, and I thought that made sense, but.
Councilmember Higgins, overall, certainly in this area, then as we look at the mixed-use employment area throughout the city, there are areas where that campus-type idea, and if we do think of a university campus, if that's what we mean, fits. There are certainly parts in the Interloop area where we're going to be looking for a little bit more urban village-type character at intersections, and maybe some areas where we'll be looking for a more suburban industrial-type look. And so we thought it was maybe a little restrictive to have that as part of the definition. It still has a coordinated environment. We still have the overall plan goals that will help us work towards some of those forms and coordination of the development that occurs.
Okay. Any other questions? Yeah. Councilmember Richens.
How does the general plan designations fit in with the zoning code rewrite that we're currently undertaking?
Mayor, Councilmember Richens, that's certainly a big part of what we're doing, and Gordon Sheffield will be talking about in a little bit here, our zoning code update. But the goal from the beginning has been to bring the general plan and zoning ordinance into greater conformity. And we are looking at modifications to our different mixed-use designations, PAD designations, and so forth, so that we can better implement mixed-use type projects in the future through our zoning code.
So do these modifications help achieve that goal? Or is this a temporary patch until we get that?
They are they're related, but they are different. This is not really looked at as a temporary patch because this is a general plan side, and then we will do the zoning to help implement this general plan designation.
Okay, so this change will help us when we implement the new zoning code?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
I have a little bit of a problem with your definition of residential. I understand what you're trying to accomplish there. The problem I have is with high-density residential. High-density is a numerical definition, and this may actually work. I don't know that that's what we really want to accomplish. I think we want an urban-style residential. And if we go just high-density, for example, you could have a situation where a loft development would be perfectly not only acceptable but desirable, and yet the density would not put it in the high density area, and so you'd have a medium density that under this we wouldn't be able to do. And so I think you need to relook at that residential development as to the type of development rather than the numbers.
Okay.
I think one of the issues we have in going forward, and certainly with a form base, is that we get away from numbers and more to type and more to form of the development that's going on. So if you could look at that as a,
sure can.
As a change and define that. And I think you did a good job before or before this in the rewrite in coming up with different types of forms. Even the campus, you have a difficulty in understanding exactly what it means, but if you just leave it coordinated, I sort of get a feeling or a vision as to what that is. So if you'd look at that one right there.
Okay. Will do. Okay. Then moving on to the next items. Another item that was recommended in the Mesa Gateway Plan is that we look at our definition for what it takes to be a minor and a major amendment in this area. We do have different definition of what it takes to be a major amendment throughout different areas of the city because of the different impacts that we're looking for. In the Mesa Gateway area, we have defined any change from employment to residential as being a major amendment. Doesn't matter how big or small it is. Any other change, it requires at least 320 acres of a change before we call it a major amendment. That's pretty consistent around the rest of the city. In the particular area that we're talking about, where we see the biggest need for a change, going from a light industrial to mixed-use employment would be a minor change up to 320 acres. Given the mixed-use community area, which already has most of it in the mixed-use community designation. We don't see many areas where we really want to encourage, even yet, a change from residential to employment. Excuse me, I said that backwards. From employment to residential. And so, and then the rest of any changes from industrial to commercial or commercial to industrial, those minor changes can go up to 320 acres, which, again, is similar to the city. So given that, staff's not really seeing a need to change the definition at this point in the area for what it takes to be a major amendment. And we propose to leave that alone. And then finally, in terms of applying the mixed-use employment designation to that interloop area, we have a couple of choices how we can approach that. Certainly anything we do would work with the property owners in the area and get their consensus and support for whatever we may do. Once we've changed the definition, we could look at one major plan amendment to apply it throughout that area for all the property owners who are interested in doing so and get that done in one action. The other would be, again, to work more individually with the property owners and do it as a series of minor plan amendments so that it's maybe not quite as overwhelming with staff to work on that and get that processed. And, of course, the other option is just change the definition and not do anything, just leave it for the individual property owners to handle as they may choose. The benefit, we think, from going ahead and working with the property owners and getting it done up front is to move forward with implementing the Mesa Gateway Plan and also provide that assistance to the property owners to help implement the plan and have them more ready for development as other infrastructure items come online and economy turns around and so forth. So staff would be willing to, is recommending that we work with those property owners and help get them through that minor plan amendment process to get their property situated with the mixed-use employment designation.
Councilmember Higgins?
Can you explain some more detail, maybe how you came up with or why you want to change the definition of the major plan amendment? I don't see all the reasons here.
Councilmember Higgins, and I didn't go into them in any detail here. Maybe I should have, but in the Mesa Gateway Plan, as we were developing that, at the time we thought there would be a lot more differences between what the Gateway Plan was calling for and what the current land use designations are in the area. There would be a need for a lot of changes, and we thought that too many of those might be major plan amendments, and we might not want to have to deal with that many major plan amendments, so there would be some benefit for changing that definition, so that more of them could be handled as minor amendments and more easily processed.
Mr. Quisley, maybe we need to go back and do a primer on the difference between major and minor amendments, because I think we're assuming that everyone understands that difference.
Okay. Very good, Mayor.
So if you'd give us just a little bit of a primer so everyone can get on the same page as far as why it might be easier or facilitate our goals to have more minor than
very good.
Major.
Yes, Mayor. A minor plan amendment can be filed at any time and is processed pretty similar to any other site plan or zoning type change. It has a public review period and goes to the Planning and Zoning Board for a couple of reviews and on to council. Again, it can happen at any time. Typically, be processed in about a 4 to 5 month time frame from a formal application. Major plan amendments, they can be filed one time a year. All major amendments filed in 1 year have to be heard by council at one time in the year. And that process is usually around a 9 month process to go through it and has more extensive public review and comment periods. It's a 60-day review period where we have to send the notice out to a lot of different groups and agencies if they can provide comments and so forth. It's much more involved process and limiting for when you can make those changes. And so, again, if we're trying to encourage moving towards implementing the Mesa Gateway plan, hurdle or roadblock to doing that can be a requirement to go through a major plan amendment process because you can't do those as often. If you get a couple of months down the road here, we couldn't do one this year and get it done by the end of the year, and a person would have to wait a whole year then to make those changes to their property. So that's why we thought we would need to look and see, do we want to make more things minor plan amendments? But again, we haven't found a significant need for that the way it ended up.
Councilmember Higgins.
So the changes that you're suggesting are actually like item number 3 on that previous list, change from light industrial to mixed-use employment. It's a minor up to 320 acres because this is actually kind of what you were planning for that area anyway?
Correct.
Okay. Right. So, you know, just, you know.
If we try to do the whole inner loop area that's currently light industrial and want to make it all mixed-use community or mixed-use employment, it is more than 320 acres. If we do it all at one time, it would require a major amendment. Mm-hmm. If we hurry up and make that decision, we could still process that this year. But again, given our staff resources and probably not all the property owners will be ready right now, we could break it up into a series of minor plan amendments and do those that are ready right now and just keep them each under 320 acres.
Right, because, you know, the general plan, big item, we don't want to just change it willy-nilly, right, as you know. Right. All right, thank you.
Once again, I understand that size does matter in this case because of the complexity or the what you have to look at. But I'd also like to, it would seem like regardless of the size, if we have a proposed change that is consistent or brings the property consistent with what we've approved on the general definitions under the strategic plan that we've approved, it seems like whether that's 2 acres or 2,000 acres, that should be easily facilitated because it brings it into conformity or it makes it consistent with what we've already approved with the Gateway Strategic Plan. On the other hand, if we have something that moves away from that or that seeks to deviate from what we have approved on the general general strategic plan that we have, it seems like whether that's 1 acre or 1,000 acres, that should be something that we should really take a look at, and it should be a more difficult process because it deviates from what we've already approved. So I tend to think less in the acreage, and you could have a 1 acre parcel that someone wants to come in and theoretically, because of the size, would be a minor general plan, but if it deviates from what has already been approved in the development, that to me is a major change because it has the potential to have a ripple effect on surrounding properties and even the direction of maybe a much larger area. So if I would like it if perhaps you could include wording in there that refers to our existing approved strategic development plan and has movement by the applicant or proposed movement either consistent with or in contradiction with that plan be factored in to the definition of a major or minor.
Sure, Mayor, we can do that. Again, we're going to be taking this back through a public review process through planning and zoning coming back. So we'll look at that as another way to look at the definition that any change consistent with an adopted area plan can.
To me, that should almost be an administrative matter. I mean, you're just basically bringing definitions in because we've already basically approved that. We've already defined that. Anything that deviates from that, regardless of the land size, because once again, I've seen 1 acre parcels that can poison the well for an entire half section because the use is so extreme and is so out of whack with what was planned that all of a sudden it really affects anything that comes down the pike. And yet, because it was only, you know, 1 acre maybe is a little drastic, but 5 acres or 10 acres, it was a minor plan. It went through, and these plans and these plan amendments, whether we like it or not, tend to be looked at as silos. We don't do as good a job as we should in taking a 10-acre parcel and truly looking at the overall effect on the community, meaning whether that community's the 20 adjacent acres or the 2,000 adjacent acres. That seems to get, not lost, but certainly in the past, we have a tendency to overlook the long-reaching effects. And that's what I think we have a real danger of here in the Gateway, where we have so much undeveloped property. And we're going to have demands as the market continues, whether it continues as a bad market or it explodes. Either way, this council and the city is going to have tremendous pressures from landowners to deviate from the overall plan. That's going to happen. We know it. We've seen it. It's going to happen. And I think that we ought to set in process right now things that facilitate compliance with the overall plan and really make it difficult to deviate from that. Because I think in our strategic plan, we have created enough flexibility and enough leeway that any property owner can comply with that plan and still be successful in development of their property. And I think the more that we facilitate that or encourage that, the better off we are. On the other hand, anyone who wants to deviate from that, I think it should be very difficult, because we've already gone through that process. Mm-hmm. And now they're trying to undo what's already been done. So they should have a pretty dang good reason why that property should deviate, because there will be effects on their neighboring properties. So however you can put that in, okay. That's what I'd like to see.
Okay, we'll work on that. Very good. Okay.
Councilmember Richens?
Now, the Gateway Strategic Plan was approved by us, but the general plan's approved by voters. Is there any conflict or challenge between those two items?
Mayor, Councilmember Richens, what we're talking about now, though, is the definition of a major general plan and the definition of a minor general plan. And the council does have the authority to define those two terms. And then the statute defines, okay, whatever is a major general plan amendment has this process to follow. Whatever is a minor general plan amendment has this process to follow. But it's the council's discretion to define those two terms. So that's what the mayor and John are talking about now, is how do you want to define what a major general plan amendment is, and then the statute would dictate whatever falls into that category must comply with this process.
Okay, thanks.
And to further it, what was approved by the voters is what is in place right now. We have approved a strategic plan anticipating that many of those that have already been defined that are in place now were approved by the voters. Will seek a change in the use, because that which was approved by the voters, we're assuming many of those are, I don't say out of date, but we've changed, we've adjusted the focus, and so there will be requests, and there will be times when we would like to see that tweaked. So in a sense, property by property, it will go through to where we change in some areas, as Mr. West has pointed out, that which was approved by voters.
Is it the correct view to assume that some of the changes in the Gateway Strategic Plan have added much more value to the property in that area from a planning standpoint?
Well,
is that?
I certainly hope so. Because if we're going the other way, then we're not doing our job. I think you're exactly right. I think with the flexibility and what we've offered and remember when that 2025 plan was both developed and was approved, it was a different area. We didn't have a freeway that was in existence. We had one on paper, but the perception of the area and the reality of the area is very different now than it was even 3 or 4 years ago, before that freeway got in. I think we can see that, you know, looking at an aerial with a freeway overlaid on the aerial is much different than actually driving on a completed freeway. Mm-hmm. You know, the perception of the property changes, and the actual use of the property in many ways changes. And I think that's what that's the situation we're dealing with here, is as we go through from concept to reality, there's going to be some refinement. And I think that refinement does exactly what you're saying, Councilmember Richens, is that it does enhance both the ability to develop and also the true potential of that development.
Okay.
Thank any
you,
other
Mayor.
Questions?
Council, that was it. Unless there are any other questions. Again, with that, we will be looking at, sounds like, a change to mixed-use employment definition. We will look at the definition for what's a major amendment, as you just talked about. And with those two things in mind, And once we get those through the process, work with property owners to help them then facilitate changing that inner loop area to the new designation.
Great. Okay. Thank you. Okay. Item number two, I think, are you staying up there for that?
Actually, Mr. Sheffield.
Is that Mr. Sheffield?
Yeah.
Gordon?
Take over.
Hear a presentation, discuss, and provide direction on the zoning code update.
Mayor, council members, what I'd like to do today is give you a very, very brief progress report on where we're at in terms of schematically from the in terms of the zoning ordinance update. Talk about module three. We've broken the project into four basic parts, and we're on the third of these. And then talk to you a little bit about what actually constitutes a form-based code. This is about a 180-degree turn from the type of zoning that the city practices now. And it's fundamentally different. And the assumptions that go into it and some of the practices that are part of a form-based code are very, very different than what the city practices now. And so we want to make sure that the council understands those and make sure, and if they feel that this is the direction we want to take, we want to make sure we include those as part of this update project. When we contracted with our consultant, which is Dyett & Bahti of San Francisco, this is the list of things that we contracted for. They were going to do some research. They're going to get out and talk with the people who use the zoning code as well as the general community. They were researching the existing policies that the council had at the time. They developed a product called an Issues and Options Working Paper, which we've used as kind of a backdrop for what kind of changes need to take place to the ordinance itself. From that, we developed an annotated outline that included a major reformatting that we were going to propose as part of the update. And to date, we've completed the first of the four parts that we've talked about, Module 1, which talked about land use classifications, and Module 2, which talks about development standards. We completed the public review of Module 2. We're 95% complete with the public review of Module 2. We're getting ready to send our comments back to the consultant for that, for modification. We're just now beginning Module 3, and this is going to kind of be the kickoff point for that as part of this presentation. Module 4 we have just received from the applicant. We're doing our staff review of that right now and getting ready to send staff comments back probably within the next month or so. And our public reviews of Module 3 and Module 4 will probably kind of be somewhat concurrent as we kind of go through this because they're not quite as detailed as Module 1's and Module 2. So with Module 3, we have our public review. Again, Module 4, the staff and public review. From there, we'll go to a consolidated draft. We'll put all these parts together, and we'll add graphics to that to try to make it more understandable. And then from that, we'll take the consolidated draft back through the public review period and get comments on that to make sure that the four parts work together as a whole. And then we'll start work going through the adoption and implementation process. This is just a real brief update on the goals that we started with. You can see that there are quite a few of those types of things. A lot of it just has to do with increasing the ease of use, making it simpler to use. We're trying to recognize the diversity of the city, as well as increase things like predictability and modernizing administration and processing. Just a real quick example of something that we've done already in terms of increasing use of and simplifying understanding. We're trying to reduce the narrative. You're going to see more graphics on this type of thing. We're going to use tables, increase amount of same page information that you can get. And then long term, we're trying to get to a point where we can computerize the zoning code. So if someone's trying to find information on that, they can click on a hypertext link, a one spot, and it'll take it to a related section of the code, and so they don't have to flip pages back and forth. So if they're doing a code review of some kind, it'll make it easier for them to do that. Example kind of what the present code looks like on the left and what the proposed update looks like on the right. This is from Module 1. You can see basically it's fairly narrative oriented, very, very word oriented. Table 2, and there's specific examples in the packets that I handed out to you. On the next page, you can see that the table tends to try to provide a lot of information, and you can do comparatives. at the same time. Not only can you see whether it's a permitted use or a special use permit use or a council use permit use, but you can also determine whether or not it's a prohibited use by the use of the dash that's there. And so you get a lot of information on one page without having to flip back and forth through the code. So we feel that that's going to be a lot easier for people to understand, as well as get that information up front without flipping back and forth through the book. Any questions about some of the formatting that we've done at all? Okay. Then we'll get into Module 3. Module 3 governs overlay districts, parking, and landscaping. This is a real quick list of the overlay districts that are proposed as part of Module 3. They're pretty much the same list that we have now under the current zoning code. There is one new overlay we're proposing, which is an IN overlay or infill overlay district. The airfield overlay, the proposed changes that we have to that are fairly dramatic. If you read the existing airfield overlay that we have now, there are actually restrictions to land uses that are in that, and quite frankly, they don't work. That's why it has not been applied as an overlay district very much. In fact, the prior Falcon Field Airport director told us they didn't even want it outside of Falcon Field. We've only applied it in situations where the airfield district was with Maricopa County and we annexed the property, or in certain industrial sites that are right off the airport. So from this new airfield overlay district, what we've done is to revise to be more consistent with the strategic plan that Mr. Wesley just proposed, and it gets away from most of the land use restrictions and basically just requires more notification. Talks about the proximity of that particular land that the overlay district would apply to the airport, and it talks about some noise attenuation standards. So it requires a construction standard on top of that, so that the difference between the outside noise and the inside noise would be attenuated by 25 decibels. This is quite frankly, it's something we do on a regular basis with stipulations on zoning cases in this area. This would just apply that more directly through the overlay district. The other thing that this would add is notices on subdivision plats, would make it mandatory for avigation easements. People who sell land in the area would have to post notice in the area that there's an airport nearby. In addition to that, if there were any apartments or any kind of high-density housing that was in that area, any kind of rental type of thing, there would be a requirement that as part of the rental contract, those folks would be notified that there's an airport nearby. So it doesn't require anything outside of just notification that the airport's a couple of miles down the road. Age-specific overlay district, this is a district that basically requires residency to at least one resident to be 55 years old or older. This is very rarely used. This is something that was done primarily in 1985 to facilitate annexation of retirement communities on the east side of town. We have not applied this, to my knowledge, in at least 23 years to a new district, to a new area that has not been or previously applied for that in the county. One revision that we would have for this is that under the current code, if for some reason someone becomes a resident of the property and they're under 55 years of age, they're required to go through a public hearing process through the Board of Adjustment, a special use permit. What we're proposing with this is that rather than make that a public hearing, we were proposing to make this an administrative use permit under very limited conditions. The idea would be, for example, if you had a situation where someone was 57 years old and they had a spouse that was 45 years old, for example, and the person that was over 55 died for some reason, but the person that was under 55 years old, in theory, under the zoning code, they'd have to be kicked out of the house. And we didn't want to get into those types of situations. So we wanted to address that through a non-public hearing process and allow that person to remain in the home.
Gordon, if we have a situation like we had before, because we have a lot of, and I don't know what their county designation is, but they're in county islands that at some point in time will maybe come into the city, I don't know. What is the grandfathering as it relates to age specific? Would our administrative process be implemented for county zoning, whether or not that included that, or would we have to do something as part of annexation, or how would that work?
Whenever the city annexes property, it's required by state law to establish what is the closest comparable zone to what the county had already established. The reason that the city has this age-specific overlay is that Maricopa County has something called Senior Citizens, or SC, Overlay District. And so when the city was trying to facilitate these annexations in 1985 to up its population counts, the people who lived in these SC overlay districts had very strong concerns that the city was going to take away these age restrictions for some reason. So the council facilitated these annexations by adopting this age-specific overlay district. We would do the same thing. For example, if there was a very large county island outside of Superstition Springs called Leisure World. If the city were ever to annex that particular property, we would basically try to establish the same zoning districts the county has on the property, the R16, the R2, same base districts. But because we have the age-specific overlay district, and Leisure World also has the senior citizen overlay district, we would establish age-specific overlay district at the same time. They would get the same protections, basically, that the county zoning okay. has.
And then our administrative process that you're looking at here would then,
right.
would then apply that.
And that, okay. would, that would change because in the county, to do the same thing requires a public hearing. We would be able to do that administratively, so
okay.
we don't. We avoid that.
I guess that's what I was getting to.
Sure.
Okay.
Okay. Any questions about that?
Councilmember Fender.
Before we get too far away from the airfield overlay, I was sitting reflecting back from the P&Z days with regard to noise and attenuation standards. I remember a case coming through that was going to be, they were in the flight area. It was an indoor pool, and they were requiring quite a bit of upgraded building materials and noise attenuation. It seems so dramatically unreasonable. Is there a check and balance in the system as we're looking at this to say, you know, look at the type of use or how we're doing that as far as those standards go? Or,
As this would stand, this would change the standards for those areas that already have airfield overlay district. For the site that you're talking about, if I remember correctly, was on Power Road north of Elliott. The primarily what we're proposing the airfield overlay district would be to be limited to those areas affected by the noise contour, the 65 LDN line. Those lines have shrunk dramatically because of some new Part 150 studies that have been done. The result of that is that, I think that site may not be affected by this particular overlay district anymore. Right.
For the future, though, and you know, I think we've tried to keep an open mind of what possible uses or you know, way past residential. Would there be a process in place if you could say, hey, this is going to be an indoor racquetball court or mm-hmm. something like that? Probably don't need that noise attenuation.
That's certainly something we can work with the applicant on. Most commercial construction already attenuates sound to the decibel level that we're talking about. So hopefully that doesn't happen, but certainly we're trying to be flexible enough and open-minded enough to work with the applicants on those things.
I understand that you try to be open in that. Is there any way that we could maybe put that in the thing that says we're going to be using mm-hmm. common sense? Because sometimes common sense, I know you have common sense, but I don't know if your successor or someone on another department is going to have common sense.
Sure.
And it seems like it should be fairly simple. Right. If airplanes are going to fly over someplace where people live or work, that seems common sense. If it's going to fly over somebody where they're already playing tennis or whatever, you know, it seems like we're getting into a situation where why are we regulating that when it's an activity that really doesn't seem to be affected by it. So if we could look at just something that would
sure.
maybe instill some common sense so we can give some direction to the next person and the applicant down the road. So if we have a swimming pool or a tennis court or something like that, that just, and that's not going to come up very often, but when it does come up, it becomes a huge deal.
Sure.
So, Councilmember Richens?
It also seems like there's a kind of a buyer beware situation too around airfields. Do we require realtors to carry noise contour maps? I know some cities on the west side require anybody that deals with real estate around an airport carries noise contour maps, and they said this property is right here in this noise contour, so you know, and they sign off on it as part of their process. Is that something that we
haven't extended it to requiring people to carry maps with them? Not that I know of, anyway.
You know, your property is I'm under the Falcon Field flight. It was attached to my deed of my property.
Yeah, I'm the same for Sky Harbor, so I had that stuff.
But you didn't get the noise contour.
I have stuff, you know, I didn't see noise contours, but I said that, you know, one of the things is airplane noise. But I don't know. It's just a concept, actually, that a constituent suggested to me at one time that if we're going to do this, maybe we should publish those noise contour maps and make sure that people see them. And I'm it's just when there's an airport that's been there for 60 years and somebody comes back and says there's noise.
I guess what I'm hearing is that We have these requirements for notification. How do we know that the notification's taken place, and how do we know that people who are out there in the market understand that their property may, if there's something on a deed, then it should be buyer beware because it's sitting there. But I guess what you're saying is how do we make sure that they actually understand?
As part of that, I mean, if we have an airport, an overlay district for the airfield, how are we protecting that? And is that something that we want to embed in this process so we make sure we're protecting that?
Well, I guess the question is, what if they didn't do it? I mean, you know, we don't regulate real estate agents at the city level. It's a state function.
Mm-hmm.
What if they don't carry it? I mean, what if they don't notify right now?
I don't know the answer to that, Mayor. I know we have the requirements in place in terms of actually enforcing them. I'm not sure if we've had complaints that I didn't know this or I wasn't provided sufficient notice. We can certainly talk about what maybe the city can do in terms of encouraging individuals or certainly making it more public, the noise contour maps, if that's the desire.
I guess the other thing that I would add to that is that the stipulations that we've used previously and what this kind of tries to build on is the idea that a lot of these would come through on deeds, on easements, and then you would see those as part of the normal escrow process that you would go through and the millions of pieces of paper that you sign, so you would see that. The thing that this changes a little bit is we would add that to rental agreements.
Yeah.
And so from that standpoint, it would become more of an enforcement issue that if someone filed a complaint, and we would probably follow it up through the complaint process to find out, okay, were you notified as a tenant of this particular apartment building, whether or not there was an airport nearby? And then
we may not have an enforcement, but if there is any kind of civil action or whatever, certainly that if the landlord and or the property seller did not comply with a city regulation, that does not bode well for them as they walk into a civil case, for example. I think also this, you know, using the noise contours, I understand that that's a definable standard. Mm-hmm. I don't know that actually covers our problem, because our problem with airplane overflight, for example, at Gateway, the current traffic pattern has absolutely nothing to do with the noise contours that are in place. I mean, they're not even close. Airplanes don't even, there probably hasn't been a jet airplane follow those noise contours since literally the Air Force left 15 years ago. And to give you an example, the noise contours go straight out to the northwest from the end of the runway. The runway's 30, go straight out, and yet the current traffic flow is that they take out and they take a hard right turn and head due east. So, I'm not so sure that we shouldn't be looking for something. And I don't know where you draw the lines. But I think we can talk all day long about these noise contours, and we're going to have requirements over cotton fields, and because nobody's building there because of the noise contours, and yet we have actual traffic patterns where we're having people that aren't even notified, and yet they have airplanes flying over them all the time. Mr. Wesley.
Mayor, that's a good point, and that's why we've worked closely with the airport itself, and pretty much anything that's south of the 60 and east of Power Road, we bring
isn't
that up as a part of the site plan zoning
case. So it's not necessarily the contours,
right.
We expand.
Won't have the overlay, but through case stipulations, we can apply very similar standards.
Okay, so what we do is on a case-by-case basis, we have a generally defined area that we apply the overlay standards as stipulations to specific cases.
Correct.
Okay.
And that's as the property is developed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well,
if it's not developed, then the jackrabbits complain.
Well, then, as it's developed, but then when it's resold later, does that carry forward? Okay, thanks.
Yeah, because the stipulation runs with the land.
Right.
Okay.
All right. Okay. Bonus intensity zones and planned area developments. If you were to read the zoning ordinance right now, quite frankly, there's not much of a distinction between these two.
Which I think all of us were doing last night is reading the zoning ordinance, so...
You have my sympathy. I get to read it every day. The basic idea is that both of these authorize the city council to approve a plan-based project or approve deviations from the standard code requirements. If someone code says you're supposed to have a 30-foot setback and someone comes in with a plan that shows a 20-foot setback, but the council thinks the plan's okay, this overlay district allows the council to approve the plan and not necessarily pay attention to the specific standard. We want to continue that, but we want to refocus them a little bit. The idea is that the bonus intensity zone would be more for project-oriented types of things, and the PAD would be for multiple project types of situations, where you're dealing with a little bit larger land area. The concept we're trying to introduce here is the difference between mixed use and multiple use, and that maybe we're making too fine a line here. But the idea would be that a mixed-use project is where you would have one project that shows several activities within one project, whereas a multiple-use project, you might have several projects, but each of the projects themselves would be single-use, but the project, because it's multiple projects, works together as a whole. So that basic difference between the concept. And the idea is that the BIZ would be more mixed-use, the PAD would be more multiple-use. So you're dealing with several buildings, but that may be single-use buildings.
Councilmember Richens. Well, I just think a good example is that is what's happening at Riverview is more of a multiple-use project.
Correct.
Aquaterra is more of a mixed-use project because you're blending in the same building a multiple of uses.
Exactly.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay. So we're trying to some of the language that we're changing with the BIZ and the PAD overlay districts is to focus it more toward those types of activities, and it gives a different evaluation for each one. In addition to that, the idea behind a bonus intensity zone is that the council is giving an incentive for some reason in order to attract some particular aspect of a project. And so from that standpoint, we want to keep the idea of rewarding higher quality design. We want to introduce the idea that people might use the BIZ to get a bonus for using green building standards. We want to encourage the use of the BIZ for difficult building sites. If there's some sort of difficulty that's there, the council might give an incentive through the bonus to reward them for using the difficult site. Again, we can use it for project basis for infill. I'm sorry. Okay. We continue to use it for taller building heights. Again, the focus is the emphasis on individual projects. And we want to think about the idea of what's called inclusionary housing. And the thought behind that is that you would reserve a portion of the residential units are there for affordable housing with generally higher housing. This is be done on a voluntary basis. You had a question, Mayor?
No, I was going to make a comment on that because
okay.
that's really a hot button, and it's something that's being fought over, and I think we need to be very clear that not so much voluntary. We're not going to require this, but we're going to reward it, is I think
correct.
What I'm hearing.
Yes.
Yeah, which I think is the way to go. For example, if you want to put some inclusionary housing as part of your project, and the normal zoning would allow 10 units per acre, that we're willing to go to 12 to 15 units an acre because you've done that. I just use that as an example.
Yes.
And I think that's the way to go on this because there have been several communities who have forced that. And while it's a noble concept, what it basically does is it forces those people in that development to really subsidize others. I think we need to be perfectly clear that that's not what we're trying to do. We're trying to reward that kind of activity and encourage that kind of activity. And we're willing to give the developer some more density if they will do that, rather than force that.
I couldn't have said it better, Mayor. That's exactly the concept. The whole idea behind bonus intensity zone is to give the bonus or to reward the activity, it's more of the carrot approach than the stick approach.
Which gets me back to green building construction, and I've sort of skipped ahead on some of your slides, so I apologize, but it seems like this is the place where it shows up, and I was wondering if across the board, if we couldn't include that and that consideration as far as green building to a lot of our different overlays and things like that, that if the developer will use some green, that there is some sort of incentive to do that. Some sort of, once again, reward. I hate to use the word incentive. Some sort of reward if they'll do that, whether it be through flexibility, whether it be through planning or other kind of thing. And I don't know how that incorporates in other areas, but if you could also look at green.
Sure.
I think that was one of the strategic initiatives of this council, as we identified, as we wanted to encourage green development, and the best way to do that is to embed it in our in our zoning codes. And once again, I also think that this council said they don't want to use the hammer, they do want to use the carrot approach, which is to encourage through facilitating, through reward, through that type of thing, which I think is a good policy.
Sure. Okay. Yeah, no, I think we can do that.
Okay. Is that okay with everyone else? Okay.
Okay. Planned area development. The idea basically here is to use the idea of density averaging or density transfer, the basically smaller lots to reward open space. We're trying to get combinations of land uses through multiple land uses, encourage interties, and consider the project as a whole. Just real quick, graphically, this is from the Lincoln. I swiped these from the Lincoln Land Use Institute, but this just kind of shows the difference between a PAD approach and a conventional approach. The idea on the left is it's typical street pattern you would see for five units to single-family dwelling, five dwelling units to the acre. Pretty much the same pattern up and down with just nothing but lots. The example on the right, you see lots of open space, the use of lakes. You end up with smaller lots, but because you count the open space in the density calculation, you end up in the same place. And so even though you might have smaller lots, the density is still five units to the acre. It gives the developer the incentive for providing those open spaces, for preserving those washes, and for doing things like that. So we would continue to propose that the PAD be used for that purpose. Development master plans, these are for very large scale projects. This is on the concept of a Dobson Ranch or a Los Cendis. The idea is the long-term development of the property in a mix of uses, and gives the city and the developer a chance to plan and lay those things out. Again, we plan the averaging concept, and the idea is to also to take a look at future land uses and reserve those for conceptual activities. We continue the use of historic overlays. The changes here basically are bringing the language that's in the historic preservation and historic landmark ordinances up to national norms. For example, we use clearance instead of certificate of appropriateness, and that the certificate of appropriateness is the national norm.
Let me ask you, Debbie, Gordon, I guess you could answer. What is the status of historic overlays in relation to 207? Wasn't there a case in Tempe or?
Mayor, I think it's in Flagstaff, okay. And it's not been decided yet. So it's still pending. Is the latest I've heard. So yes, that is a question in terms of can you do a general overlay,
yeah,
as opposed to only
parcel specific. Well, and just so everyone, I guess I asked
specific.
A question that I should have explained. Prop 207 is one that requires compensation if through a zoning action or other government action the property has been devalued. And the question is, does a historic overlay, I think the gist of the court case is, does a historic overlay, which was applied on a general area in Flagstaff, and one of the property owners came in and filed a Prop 47 or challenged it under a 207, saying that historic overlay devalued their property because it restricted use of their property. And the big question is, wait a second, historic overlay should increase the value of your property. And I think, isn't that the gist of the argument there?
Yes, but this court case won't give the
right
answer to that global question. It will have to be parcel specific. So
yeah, but that's really the question is, you know, how do you define the devaluation or loss of use or whatever? And I think the idea in historic overlay is that by preserving the historic nature, you actually preserve the values for the whole, and you increase it because it's been shown that increases, although there are people who say, wait a second, if you say I can't change the front porch on my house, you've restricted my use, which devalues my property. That question I don't think will ever be answered by anyone. But in the meantime, I don't know that we would rush out right now. There's no movement to rush out and start, like there was years ago, to start throwing historic overlay tags on.
Is there
Councilor Cavanaugh?
I think we have one neighborhood, Fraser Fields, which has been stuck in limbo because of the 207, because that neighborhood has been working for 5 years to seek a historic overlay.
They have status.
Haven't they?
Pretty sure they have.
Yeah, Mayor, Councilmember Cavanaugh, they actually have the local designation.
It's
a national,
right,
designation that's working its way through a lengthy process that's at the national level now to get the final national approval.
For that, but not under the state, not under...
It's been through the statements at the national level.
It
already has a local designation, zone designation.
But not the national.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. Okay.
There's several others, too. There's the Clark Edition, and then, I mean, you have all these other neighborhoods that are hitting 50 years old, too, that first ring of suburbs around downtown that are going to come into play pretty quickly.
I know people get pretty excited about this. This is really a, not a historical, but hysterical designation. Thought of that all morning. No, go ahead.
Okay, but
please.
Anyway, the language in the ordinance stays largely, is basically gets updated, becomes a little bit more specific. It's not quite as general as it was originally written. And again, like I said, the terms that they use are tried to become rectified more to the national ones that are used in, for example, the Secretary of Interior standards, which are the kind of the national standards for historic preservation districts. Any questions? Okay. The new overlay district, the IN or the infill district. The idea behind this is that the city's current infill process involves something called a development incentive permit. The development incentive permit is a project that would go through the Board of Adjustment, and the idea is that the project is reviewed under what are the consistent standards with what the area is for bypass properties. But it's limited to projects that are up to 2.5 acres in size or 4 acres in size if you assemble land together. What this would do is kind of fill in that gap for those larger sites for larger infill properties. And in doing that, it kind of rewards a bonus. If the council were to apply this on an initiative basis where it's a council-initiated rather than an owner-initiated type of site, by doing that, then an owner can come in at some time and without having to go back through a rezoning process, they would apply to the zoning administrator for example, some reductions to landscape standards or some reductions to parking standards in order to make projects work. And that basically would help try to facilitate or streamline the review process that way. So it rewards pre-planning, kind of getting out ahead of the project, so to speak.
Does it limit or does it define what standards? You mentioned landscape or parking, but I think in infill you have things like setback requirements, lot coverage, and things like that that have a far greater effect on the viability of a project.
Yeah, all of those would be included.
Okay, so all those would be included. Yes. Okay. Councilmember Richens?
I noticed in the draft, as I was reading, this one hits home for Northwest Mesa quite a bit. And I was reading through the draft on this, and we have some language in here talking about targeted applicants for low-income employment or low and moderate income employment, encouraging that and giving densities to add it on when they add on or expand a business based on those. Some of the concern I had with that was, you know, how are we going to monitor that? Is it following the national standards for enterprise zones or any CDBG requirements that if those things are overlaid or embedded that we capture monitoring there? It just looked like kind of a regulatory nightmare. How would we really make sure that that happened other than at time of construction?
Mayor, Councilmember Richens, I'm somewhat embarrassed about this, but you asked the one question that I can't answer.
The one question you can't answer?
I prepped for this for a while.
Well, I think that sounds like a challenge, doesn't it?
I'm sorry. Maybe I'm overstating my concern, but this was the one question that I was afraid was going to come up. This is the items that you see that are related to employment for infill districts is a recommendation that comes from our consultant. And unfortunately, our consultant has been on vacation, so I haven't had a chance to talk to him to find out where these came from or how they would be implemented. So unfortunately, I don't know, but I will, as soon as he comes off of vacation, you better believe I'm going to give him a call and find out if I can get a more specific answer.
They do look like they're from some of the federal enterprise zone or CDBG type regulations on there. But from our side, I look at that, and I don't know how we monitor that or set up a mechanism to monitor because there's some ongoing things that have to happen for that, and I'd almost be inclined to just
pull those out.
Pull that out because it's just complicated. You know, we can get at the concept without having to set up a mechanism to monitor that concept.
It seems like the more mechanisms you set up, once again, we're getting back into this overregulation that just discourages. Sure. It's going to be self-defeating.
Yeah, and the other thing is I wouldn't want to cluster low-income employment in just infill areas either. I would want to encourage high-income employment or any kind of employment to come in and help low-income people. Sometimes these regulations set up and it traps people or businesses in hiring people of certain income ranges. And you want to really be able to encourage an activity that will help people
increase their incomes, but because of these incentives we've given them, it's locked them into a certain cycle. So just to consider it.
Councilmember Finter.
Thanks, Gordon. This hits home for me, too. 3900 East University, we have a site that's a little less than 2.5 acres. The individual's talked about it. It's a little farm and has animals. Someday he wants to build on an office complex for his professional sons, Dennis, you know, all that kind of stuff. How would this system, new system, work? You're saying we have to have some proactivity from the council to say, hey, here's a site, or could you run through how this would work with the new system?
It'd be two things. One is if the site he's talking about is under 2.5 acres, I can probably say without too much doubt, he's probably eligible already for a development center permit. And he can go through that process to get some deviations from the ordinance, relax some of the setback standards, relax some of the landscaping standards and things that go along with that to try to incentivize development on that infill site. If it's over 2.5 acres, then there's two ways to do this. One, the council can initiate a process to place the overlay district on that property and then allow everything that comes subsequent to that to go through an administrative process and through some of the reductions that are allowed based on the ordinance standards. The second way to do that is that he can initiate that case himself, and he can have that property rezoned now if he chose to. And then after, once that's in place, then however he chooses to develop that, then he would have the ability to take advantage of those things later on. So he can initiate that case himself, or the council can initiate that case.
So as a follow-up then, if it's more than 2.5 acres and there's an opportunity for us to initiate that, I guess I'd like to learn later how we do that, because there's several sites I've been contacted about that kind of fit into this category. And if there's an advantage for some action that I can take as a council member to help them get through the process better, I'd like to learn that. So.
Okay.
And this is one area that I have a lot of interest in also, since I have a lot of experience. And I can tell you that whatever we can do to recognize the unique challenges of infill development, and that comes down, like I said, things like setback, lot coverage, where you have development standards that are designed and were implemented for suburban development, cotton field type development, and that they just don't apply, and they're a real detriment when somebody's looking at spending money on infill. By its very nature, infill development is higher risk. And when it's higher risk, then anyone who's going to invest money in that development is going to go to the place that lowers that risk, which is why we have fringe development. It's a lower risk to spend money developing out on a vacant piece of land that's on the fringe of the city, because there aren't the existing restrictions. You know, you don't have power lines in place. You don't have mm-hmm. fiber optic lines that nobody knows exist until you cut through it, and it costs you $75,000 to fix it. Not that that's ever happened to me. there are real things in infill development that we don't recognize. We assume that development is all equal, and it's not. And any regulation we have that does not take into account the additional risk that an investor makes when they develop in an infill piece, I think we need to look at very carefully, because our goal and objective, especially when you look at, for example, well, I guess all three of you, here, where we have our more mature sections of the city, we need to do whatever we can to encourage investment there. And not that we want to lower standards, but we need to make sure that we reduce the regulations and reduce the restrictions, and we, the infill should be really a bonus fill type of a thing, where we make it easy for people to not have to wade through a myriad of development standards, but we be really upfront. We try and identify those obstacles that developers have when they look at an infill piece, whether it's 1 acre or 20 acres.
Sure.
So however we do that, I like the fact that we have this new, I'd like to maybe look at it on an overall basis and really look at what we have there that might prove to be an obstacle. I mean, bringing in some of the stakeholders, people who have a lot of experience in infill, that's what they do, get their feedback, talk to those stakeholders and find out what impediments we have, both knowingly and unknowingly, in that process, because we need infill development. We need people to come into underuse and unused pieces of property in our older sections and invest. And they're not going to do it unless we create a process that allows them to do that and encourages them to do that.
I like the terms that you used earlier, which was reward instead of require. Yeah. I think that's really operative. And I'd really like to see, you know, some of the folks that have these info parcels come in. What would it take?
Right.
In our code,
we have flexibility
from a regulatory standpoint, that would make you develop this property that you've been holding on to for 10 years or 20 years.
The one thing that I want to caution the council about is that this addresses zoning. This
right.
is not. This is.
And I know, and we understand we've deviated from that, but since the subject's on the table, and we talked about development standards, we understand that's not zoning, right. But it's a forum that we have to.
No, I can appreciate that.
We have those in the room that. Do deal with development standards and other things like that. And I understand the difference between that and zoning.
Okay.
But I don't know where, you know where one ends and where the other begins, but from a developer walking in, they're all part of the same process. So just want to get it out and get it on the record.
Sure.
That's how it's going. I think you've heard the same story coming from those of us who have dealt with this in the past.
Okay. Moving on, we get into the landscaping standards. We're going to the module that you have, unfortunately, our consultant didn't catch a red line that I had placed in it, and he didn't catch the modification to some of the plant ratios, and the thought was to reduce some of the street side standards so you can actually see into the shopping centers. Right now we have a fairly high tree count requirement. We're talking about actually lowering that a little bit so that you can see between the trees to get into the shop.
Okay, I got another thing. I'm sorry. Speaking of trees and landscape.
I'm here to listen, Mayor.
You drive down, for example, University and Brown are two great examples, but Brown. You know, what's interesting is that in the past, we had these tree requirements where the city requires trees to be put right underneath power lines. And what happens when those trees grow up? SRP or the city of Mesa comes in and cuts down the trees. And they do it all the time, and it creates an ongoing maintenance nightmare because those trees can't grow up and take over the power lines. And yet you look at new developments, and they planted the same dang trees that are going to grow right up into the power lines. And whatever we do on that plant thing, we need to take into account that if there's high voltage power lines or any kind of power lines above those somehow, we need to use some common sense on that. And those landscape standards.
The APS and Salt River Project have a plant list for appropriate plant materials under power lines. We can certainly reference that as.
Yeah, I don't think right now, because there's an office development right near my house where we put trees and give them 5 years, and those trees are going to be right in those power, and their high voltage power lines are going to be right there in those power lines. And, you know, it's a little bit frustrating when I get people walk up to me and they say, can you tell me why the city allowed them to do something that they know is going to be a problem? And it is sort of a dumb moment where you go, I can't explain it, just oversight. Somehow in our process, we're not taking into account the fact that we have something above the plants that is going to create a problem.
We'll make that adjustment.
Thank you.
Kind of a reminder back from the November presentation I made on Module 2, character area designations. We have the pedestrian character areas, the auto character, that we're going to have multiple plant ratios for those. This allows something called a landscape design alternative, which allows the zoning administrator to approve with an equivalency. So if for some reason it doesn't meet the letter of the plant ratios, the zoning administrator can look at that and determine, yeah, this basically meets the intent of what those plant ratios are trying to accomplish. And then we're also trying to introduce a concept called averaging to the foundation base. Foundation base being that area that separates the building from the parking lot or from landscape. This is just a quick, and I excuse my drafting skills. The idea basically is that right now the code requires foundation bases to be measured strictly parallel to the front of the building. With the averaging concept, the idea is that if you have a 15-foot foundation base, you can have, it can vary, say, for example, between 18 feet and 12 feet, for example, and you can still get the same area that's there. So it allows, so for example, the architect to have a foundation base that's not necessarily parallel to the front of the building. And so if you take a look at the differences, if you take a look at the red circles that are up at the front, the idea is that instead of just having a straight rectangle to this, you can get trapezoids or curvilinear diagrams or those types of things. It allows the architect to design something with a little bit more flexibility and a little bit more creativity and still get the same concept. So we're trying to introduce that. Again, revise the plant ratios. We're trying to basically be able to see into the sites. In addition to that, the current code requires any increase in floor area to a particular business or to a shopping center. They have to bring the entire site into conformance with code. What this would allow is some flexibility to that so they could add to the property without having to bring the property into full conformance. And so you can do these additions without having to go through a skip process or through a variance process in order to do that. And again, it approves, it allows the zoning administrator to approve these alternative landscape designs. Get into parking standards a little bit. The several new things about parking. The idea that we allow something called a shared parking analysis, and we allow the zoning administrator to approve that. We have bicycle and motorcycle ratios. Those are new.
Gordon, just real quick on the shared parking analysis, without getting into a lot of detail, because I know we spent a lot of time on this. That an example of that would be maybe what?
The idea that there are different peaks for different land uses.
So you have a restaurant that's open in the evening
and
rather than
having
to and they're only open, you know, their peak time is the night. They can take an office building and share a parking lot and get credit for the fact that those parking spaces are going to be used rather than having to meet each use their own specific parking requirements.
That's exactly it. Again, permit small additions without requiring new parking spaces, so we can allow some flexibility there. It allows compact spaces. These are the 8x16 spaces, so that they don't necessarily have to use more land in order to do that. We allowed up to 10%, I think, is the requirement. And then it makes mandatory some bicycle parking requirements.
So speaking of parking, in the past, I know we've had some situations where we had an existing use. The building was either destroyed or the use wasn't changed, but the building was changed. And because it was built under parking standards that existed maybe 50 years ago, and now we're coming into a use that's very similar, but a new building. And I know there have been problems in the past with applying new parking standards to old uses or to existing sites, and no consideration was given to the history of the use. Do we allow that flexibility now, or is that ever put in as a consideration?
The current ordinance is not that flexible, quite honestly. Okay. There are creative ways to apply that, and staff has tried to do that on occasion, try to address those questions. We've also heard parking issue or parking variances for that. For example, we had a situation where a health gym or health club wanted to go into a former big box that used to have a grocery store in it. And health clubs have a very much higher parking ratio requirement than a grocery store does. And so what had been, like, for example, 250 parking spaces for a 35,000 square foot grocery store was now 500 parking spaces for a health club, and they just didn't have the parking field for it. And so we went through a parking variance analysis on that, and so we went through a process and we reduced the requirement. But you're absolutely right. If we didn't have those processes, we don't have an administrative process to take a look at that without requiring a public hearing. This update to the code would allow that.
Okay.
And it would give me the flexibility as a zoning administrator to
approve. On an administrative level?
Yes.
Okay, good. All right.
Okay. Motorcycle and scooter parking, we don't take into account any of those types of things. This would allow a certain percentage of spaces. Basically, you could divide an existing car parking space into two motorcycle parking spaces, and it would be counted as two spaces instead of one space. It specifies pedestrian connections, so we connect the building to the street. It simplifies the loading requirements. Right now, quite honestly, the loading requirements, you have to have an advanced degree in calculus to understand when they apply. This definitely simplifies those. Ratios remain largely the same, so the number of parking spaces required for a restaurant is largely the same now under the proposal as it is now under the existing code, and the size of the parking spaces remain the same. The parking spaces, for example, in Gilbert are now 10x20. Mesa's pretty much firm on a 9x18 standard. We feel that works, But, and we give the developer the option to go to a bigger standard if they want to with that. Again, we're adding flexibility. We allow some additions now, and it gives me the ability to approve some alternatives, including alternative dustproof materials. I would have to work with some standards with the environmental folks on that. It also allows me to take into account things like transit, valet parking, off-site parking spaces. For example, Banner Baywood or Banner Desert is currently doing that now with the construction on their site. They're parking on the old Motorola campus and doing shuttle between the two sites. I can take into account special needs circumstances, for example, assisted living. I can take that into account when we're trying to develop parking calculations for this. So it gives me a lot more flexibility in determining what constitutes the appropriate parking count for the site. Do you want to go into form-based codes real quick? I know we spent quite a bit of time on this.
Yeah, go ahead. Councilmember Higgins?
I just wondered, back a couple steps to the landscaping issues. Mm-hmm. Will this give you the flexibility for airport developments to not have to go through variance requirements when obviously they can't put landscape and rocks near an airplane that's passing by? I mean, you know what I'm talking about right now,
yeah.
Right? Typically, if I go in and want to put an office in an airport area, the code says I need landscape and all that stuff. And, of course, you can't have landscaping near an airplane. And now I think they have to come through a variance, too.
Correct. It would give me some flexibility to that. It wouldn't eliminate the landscaping requirement entirely. The landscaping issues involving Falcon Field we're hoping to address with a zoning case fairly soon. The thought would be to approve or to bring forth a planned area development case, overlay district case for the airport, whereby the council would specifically approve deviations to standards that would reduce landscaping.
Okay.
But we're still working with the airport director on that case.
Okay.
Just a quick question.
Councilmember Pinter.
Thanks. Again, your position as zoning administrator, so as we talk about these processes, an individual, good common sense, some flexibility, you'll be able to look at that at administrative level. What would be the appeals process past, say someone comes in, and how does that work?
Appeals for zoning administrator decisions go to the Board of Adjustment. And so if someone disagrees with the decision that I would make, it would go to the Board of Adjustment through just a standard. It's similar to a variance process. It doesn't, the review of a ZA decision is not quite the same. It doesn't have the same legal test that a variance does, but it's a similar type of review.
Any other questions? As far as form-based, I have two thoughts on that. Number one, we've talked about it quite a bit, mm-hmm. and I'm not sure we need to go into the basics of it. The other thing is if there are things in addition to that, we might, because we'll run up on a time constraint here.
Sure.
If we want to maybe, if you have some things that expand on what we've talked about before, then maybe what we ought to do is break this up and have you come back another time.
Yeah, Mayor, I think we can do it next Thursday.
Let's do that then, okay, yeah. If that's all right. Come back and just talk about the form base. Because, you probably didn't plan on spending as much time on the first part, but I thought we had some good discussion here and some good questions. Even though we did get into other areas, they're all connected. So. So maybe if you come back next Thursday.
Sure.
And let's go over the form base at that time.
The only thing that I really wanted to add as far as the form base code to some of the stuff we discussed is the concept of the regulating plan and the idea that there's two steps to the process. One is getting the basics of the district, and the second is the actual implementation, and that's done through another planning process. But we'll explain that in
let's go into it when we're not up against time constraints, because I don't want to limit what you've got. I want to have a good discussion. If that discussion is anything like this discussion, it'll go longer than what we anticipated. So let's do that next Thursday, if
that's
okay.
Fine.
Councilmember Richens?
Yeah, and it's important to get this information for the public to understand, too. So that's why we'll have a good, robust discussion Thursday. Because people are getting a lot of questions about what is this. And so it'll be good to get this information out. Thanks.
Well, and I get a lot of questions and a lot of comments as far as how the new zoning code and how our new standards fit in with what we've defined as. And I think staff is also pushing for this to simplify, to facilitate, to encourage, to reward, that type of approach. And so there is a lot of interest, not only in the development community, but in the community as a whole as to the approach we're taking. And I think we need to spend adequate time in really going over these things. So thank you very much for for the presentation, but also thank you for a lot of the work. It's pretty impressive to see how, like you said, in many ways we've shifted 180 degrees from the way things were done, and that I understand that that's not an easy transition. And just from this morning, the issues we brought up, I know this just scratched the surface of the things you have dealt with as a staff and as you've gone through these things, both within your department, but also with the consultant and with others to come up with a plan that doesn't create unintended consequences or which I know are unavoidable to a certain extent. But thank you for the time and effort you've put into that. Okay. Next item here, reports on meetings and or conferences attended. Nothing? Oh. No, I'd just like to comment. We all know, you know, President Obama was in town yesterday. I'd like to commend both the Mesa Police Department, who played a significant role in the security, traffic control, and other things, and did a great job, because it looked like everything went smoothly. The setup and everything was under their control. Everything basically outside the building itself was Mesa PD, and then the Secret Service took over once you got in close proximity. So they did a great job. Mesa Public Schools, congratulations. It was an honor. And I'd like to say one thing. Regardless of whether you agree, disagree with President Obama's policies, and I think there are just a few differences in this community, you know, to me it's an honor anytime the President of the United States, regardless of what you think of their politics, visits your community. And even though, like we said, well, unless it's a hurricane or a earthquake or something like that, and some people would say that this is the equivalent of a hurricane or a disaster, I think the fact that our area was highlighted, and maybe not for a reason that we'd like to celebrate, which is the trials and the struggles of this financial crisis, and certainly with the foreclosures, the fact that we were focused on this area, you know, to me is a, and I think to a lot of people is a big deal. And we're glad that he was here. We're glad that he talked about a real problem that we are facing and that our citizens are facing on a daily basis. And hopefully it'll serve as a springboard to some really substantive discussion as to how we work our way out of this. And I, you know, I had the opportunity to meet with the president afterwards, and it was really interesting because, he asked me for some very specific questions about how this crisis is affecting our community. And I assured him that, he needed to remember where he was. He's in a place where, which was a desert, and the people who have lived in this desert for thousands of years and the last 130 years in our modern history have conquered this desert. And there are some challenges and some serious things that these people, we who live here, have overcome. This pales in comparison with some of the other things we've overcome, which isn't to diminish what we're going through right now, but to say that we will get through this. We will overcome this. We will come out of this bigger, better, stronger. And, you know, the President and I talked about that for a while. So I was encouraged by that, and the fact that he really was interested in what we are going through on a local basis, which gave me some confidence that maybe somebody is listening back there, and hopefully it'll translate into policy that benefits us. So congratulations to Mesa Public Schools and to Mesa PD for putting on a wonderful event, and an event that went by without any glitches, at least that I could see. So, unless there's something you haven't told me, Mr. Brady. you probably wouldn't tell me. Okay, anything else? All right. Mr. Brady.
Thank you, Mayor. Just a reminder, next Thursday we have a study session, and that will be followed by a general and economic development council committee meeting. And our next council meeting is Monday, March 2nd. Oh, thank you. Pancake breakfast, 205, sorry, February 21st, that's this Saturday, 8 to 10 at Station 205, which is 730 South Greenfield.
And that's halfway between Broadway and Southern on Greenfield.
Yep. We have one. Okay. Since you extended all the way out to March 2nd, it gave me an opening about February 28th. We're going to have in District 1 in Northwest Mesa our top-to-bottom event, which is a big district-wide cleanup event. A lot of volunteers are coming out and have a lot of projects from Eagle Scouts to church groups, community groups coming to spruce up and do a little spring cleaning in District 1. So if anybody wants to come out to that, we'll be meeting at in the Garden Center or in front of the Garden Center at Walmart on February 28th at 7 a.m. Breakfast will be served. Riverview Walmart. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Gardner, you're here. Would you like to speak this morning, or do you want to reschedule as we discussed?
Reschedule like you suggested.
Okay.
The only reason I'm here is because several years ago this building was flooded with sewage because somebody left the toilet running. It left a bad memory in my mind, and I just come and see if it was any better.
See if it was any better.
Because I had to replace the walls and stuff. So.
Well, I think physically it's better. I don't know if the stench has gotten any better.
No,
but,
I don't know either, but I'm going to tiptoe out of here.
Okay. We're going to reschedule Mr. Gardner to next Thursday if you put him on the same thing. So we'll look forward to hearing from you next week then. Okay, Ms. Crocker, any other requests to speak from citizens' presence?
No requests, Mayor.
All right, we're going to not hold the executive session this morning, so I'll entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
I have a motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
We are adjourned. Thank you very much.